Okay, thank you, Renee. Can you hear me? What I'm going to try to do is share with you some thoughts about how one might apply this notion of an epidemiologic cascade that's initiated by this unholy alliance between an industry and a government, trying to apply this to epidemics of alcohol problems, which recur from time to time in different countries, somewhat inexplicably. And there's been a tendency recently for public health advocates first to totally ignore the alcohol industry as a factor in developments that result in waves of alcohol-related problems, or there's a tendency to demonize the alcohol industry based on circumstantial evidence, like they're the bad guys, they're marketing to children, and they're doing this and they're doing that. But we don't have any data, as we do have data showing that certain policies may affect the rates of public, the rates of liver disease or alcohol-related problems. We've got good research to look document the effects of policies on public health, but we don't have any research on the effects of the alcohol industry on consumption and public health. And that's where this theory comes in that Renee Jahil has begun to formulate. And I think if we could apply it to alcohol, we could perhaps develop methodologies that would be useful for other diseases and conditions as well. First of all, you need to be able to characterize what is happening from a public health perspective. Is there an epidemic, for example, of alcohol-related problems? The UK is a good example. If any of you have been there in the last few years, go to a town like Reading or Manchester or Leeds, and on a Friday and Saturday night, there are thousands of young people out on the streets drinking. Not unlike what we saw downtown San Francisco last night, except it's even more concentrated. And everybody's drunk. Young women are walking around half unclothed. People having accidents and injuries. Police cars all over the place. It's a real zoo in most of the small, mid-sized cities in the UK. And the question is, this didn't happen, this situation wasn't prominent until the last 15 or 20 years. And what accounts for that? We can document that there's been an increase in hazardous drinkers. There's been a rapid increase in the harm that people are experiencing from their drinking. And there's been an increase in, by some measures, in the number of people with alcohol dependence. So over a period of 15 or 20 years, we've got this rapid increase in consumption and increases in alcohol-related problems. Where does that fit into Renee's theory? It's mainly in zone B. There are a number of feedback loops that I won't get into that bring back the reaction that society has to these problems, and some cases provide a self-correcting mechanism, as we've seen in the gin epidemic of the late 17th century, early 18th century. There have been a number of epidemics that have come and gone, in part perhaps because of government action. And if we take this zone B and talk about the role of corporations in the epidemiologic cascade, you start at the top with a government, in this case the Blair government, and before that the Thatcher government, and the political factors that are conducive to industry doing what it wants. And when you put those together, you get a cascade of power that changes policy and affects, quite possibly, drinking behavior. The corporations have decisions that they make. They get conduits or organizations to carry out their decisions. They put pressure on the environment. In this case, we're talking about the drinking environment and the hosts, in this case, the drinkers. are people who are reacting to this modified environment, and when the corporations are making more profits, they are selling more beer and other types of alcohol, and that results in an increase in alcohol-related problems. So that's the theory. The problem here is, how do you establish a causal chain for these various stages, and how do you verify that these things are happening and they're resulting in alcohol-related problems? It's very difficult, and our current methodologies just aren't capable of putting together data sets, and causal chains that would explain the industry's decisions and how they impact drinking behavior. And at the same time that these things are going on, there are many other changes in society that may have nothing to do with the industry. And we may be demonizing the industry for things that they're not responsible for. So you've got to look at these different levels and figure out how to measure them, who the players are, how to document those activities, and link it down the chain until you get to drinking behavior and problems. The industry is difficult to characterize. It consists of brewers and distillers and vintners and wholesalers and multinational corporations. It's probably better to apply this theory in pure form to big corporations, because they seem to have changed the way that policy is made, and we can find some clear examples. In the UK, there were changes in 1988 in the drinking license law, and especially in 2003, which during this period, some of the things that changed quite dramatically were the availability of alcohol during most of the evening and most of the day. It used to be pubs would close down in late afternoon and by 11 o'clock at night. Now they have 24-hour licensing. So the industry is responsible for developing a set of strategies which can be, I think, documented in their inner councils, in their emails, as we've seen for the tobacco industry, and in their public statements. And certainly privatization, deregulation, tax relief, and advocacy for self-regulation of marketing are the kinds of things that are behind their corporate strategies. Industry partnerships with government were set up in the UK. The responsibility deal, which started around 2006, was an attempt by the big producers, including the global producers like Diageo, to make a commitment to foster a culture of responsible drinking that would help people drink within guidelines. And so they got together with government and were sitting at the table helping to craft alcohol policy. It took them a while to get to that table, but it has been going on for 15 years. Public health was invited to the table as part of the partnership about 3 years after they sat at the table with government and industry. The public health advocacy groups pulled out. They claimed that the process had prioritized industry views rather than pledges to put forward by the public health community. They argued that the overall policy objective was not to create a culture of responsible drinking, but to do things that would pretty much not reduce the level of drinking and the profits that the industry was realizing. So they complained about the lack of specificity in the industry's goals and the lack of effectiveness of the industry's policies that they were advocating. So we have corporate strategies that tend to get implemented not only by the CEOs, but by organizations and extenders of the industry, the advertising industry, the hospitality industry, and especially trade associations and now what we're calling social aspect organizations. Some of us are calling it social aspect public relations organizations because they have a function other than corporate social responsibility. What they're doing is enabling aggressive marketing of alcohol products, lower tax, arguing for lower taxes, and increased density of outlets, and generally efforts that are being made by these social aspect organizations to promote the health benefits of drinking while masking their activities under the general umbrella of doing good for society. There's been a dramatic growth worldwide in specific types of social aspects organizations and in trade associations. These are organizations that are basically engaged in lobbying and public relations and corporate social responsibility activities in different parts of the world. In the UK, you have the Portman Group, Drink Aware Trust, and the International Center for Alcohol Policies, who are all active in working with government to liberalize trade policies as well as alcohol policies. Their actual activities, if you monitor them closely, are lobbying for industry-favorable policies. They often present arguments that neutralize opposing views. They promote industry-favorite scientists. They're getting into the business of hiring scientists and as consultants, as well as commissioning scientists to do special studies, write chapters and books, and disseminate information. And they tend to oppose unpopular but effective policies like taxation and availability controls while supporting ineffective but popular policies like alcohol education. An example is what happened in Scotland. The first time they proposed the minimum pricing bill, that bill is up again and it's just been passed. But it took 4 years to get this through the Scottish Parliament, and it was withdrawn because of opposition from the industry and the social aspect organizations. So the industry can mobilize a number of power structures to dismantle effective policies and to oppose these policies that are designed to remediate a critical situation. The next level that the theory talks about in the epidemiological cascade is the environment of the host. And here we have the development of a really different drinking culture than exists in many countries, and certainly by contrast what happened in the UK in prior years, with the traditional pub pretty much disappearing in favor of vertical drinking establishments and late-night entertainment districts. And this has led to a modification of the local drinking environment. Because of deregulation, alcohol sold in the UK today is more affordable, more available, and more heavily marketed than any other time in the last 30 years. The number of drinking licenses has increased in Scotland and Wales and the UK dramatically. Off-sale licenses, particularly cut-rate stores, supermarkets that are selling below cost to bring people in, including young people stocking up on cheap alcohol to get drunk in on weekends, and zoning policies that have led to the bunching of alcohol outlets in late-night entertainment districts. What we then have is a situation where thousands of people are on the streets in mid-range cities drinking, standing outside the pubs, and getting drunk. And the question is, how does this differ from the traditional pub? Well, the late-night drinking economy, as it currently exists in towns and cities, is one that seems to foster controlled loss of control, people going out to get drunk. There's been an interesting sociological analysis in Leicester of how the industry commissioned studies of the drug culture scene and became alarmed in the 1980s by the fact that people were going, young people weren't drinking, they were going out and getting high on drugs. And so they altered their marketing strategy to appeal to young people and to develop products that would allow them to go out and get drunk on a cheaper level on alcohol. New product design. flavored beverages, buzz drinks, walking around with trays of shots in bars and discos, and taking money and cheap shots that people can buy for their friends, and it just makes it a lot easier to get drunk, which was the purpose of coming in there in the first place. New drinking venues, cafe bars, vertical drinking establishments. These are bars with where you can't sit down. All you can do is order a big drink and gulp it down and go up and get another one. Theme pubs, dance bars, and drink promotions. So we have a different drinking culture in the U.S. The question is that led to more drinking, and has more drinking led to alcohol problems? What we have is a good deal of evidence from the U.K. and many other countries that suggests that when affordability is greater, when availability is greater, when there's more marketing, the drinking increases, and that cascades down to drinking. So drinking problems. And so we do have a lot of evidence for the lower parts of this cascade. The drinking environment can increase the rates of drinking, and that can affect alcohol-related problems. In the UK, we have more young people drinking, more people experiencing alcohol-related problems, liver cirrhosis rates increasing dramatically in different parts of the UK, especially among females. And all of this has implications for alcohol control policies at different levels. No longer are the individual approaches that have been the most studied, no longer are they the kinds of things that we would recommend to deal with a population-level epidemic. Treatment and prevention activities are not going to get us out of this epidemic. We need to control the conduits, and more importantly, we need to control availability and affordability and access. The implications for research, I think, are that we've got to do a better job as epidemiologists to understand this cascade, to develop measures and research designs that would help us document what's going on, link things along this causal chain, and come up with population level, not only population level theories, but population level research design and methods that would allow us through qualitative research and quantitative research to look at every level of this cascade in order to understand whether there are other factors that might explain it than the alcohol industry. And if it is the industry, then I think the real challenge is to be able to control what they're doing through regulation and other matters, other procedures. Thank you.